So most of the talk we've been hearing so far have been concentrated in the 3+1 application of numerical relativity. But today we have, well, this session on the characteristic numerical relativity, more going into the actual numerics. And then in the afternoon, Peter is going to be talking about the conformal equations. So just to give you a few details of how we go about discretizing the characteristic the form of the equations. So as a reminder, this is what we have in mind. We have some word tube, some inner or outer boundary, and let's say let's just concentrate on the outgoing formulation. So we use this word tube as an inner boundary for our formulation, and then we foliate the exterior spacetime all the way to null infinity with a sequence of null hypersurfaces. We use we compactify the spacetime by just introducing a radial coordinate that is defined this way. So this x is our coordinate that we use in the code. And so if you go to, if you think of the limit of r going to infinity, then x goes to 1, and you can put everything in a finite grid. Then, since our coordinate system is more like a spherical coordinate system, you need to choose appropriate coordinates to parameterize the sphere. And you know you cannot have a single patch, so we use two angular patches in the stereographic coordinate. So that's in that way we handle the pole and the singularity of the usual spherical coordinate. Instead of dealing with tensors, we introduce a null dyad on the sphere, and we transform all tensor quantities into spin-weighted quantities, and that's a very transparent way of dealing with tensors on the sphere. We also, instead of using standard angular derivatives, we use F derivatives, which gives a very nice and transparent way of taking derivative of these quantities, these spin-weighted quantities. And so we basically have evolution in two disconnected a priori region, which are these two patches covering the sphere, and there is some overlap in these two regions, and we have to do some interpolations in order to communicate back and forth in between these two patches. That's all in the code. The derivatives are discretized using second-order center difference approximations, so our code is second order. The total number of variables is 6 times 2, the new and old level. So, and then we have two copies of those for each patch. So that's all we need as three-dimensional variables in our code. Every other temporary variable that we use is 2D, so the code is very inexpensive computer-wise. You can actually run it in this laptop if you want. Then in order to do some accurate runs, a grid this small is pretty good, and the main reason being, since the most interesting stuff, the most strong dynamic is around this area, because of this use, you have many more points near the word tube as you go radially towards infinity, then the spheres are separated by wider, larger and larger distances. So you have a natural adaptiveness built in the code. You have many more, a much better resolution here than you have out in the sky, which where you don't need that many points. And yeah, that's basically all it was. J? Well, our main variable was H, remember? If you hit it with these Qs, then you construct a complex spin-weighted field. And instead of evolving H, we evolve this J field.
No.
This is... Oh. Yeah, this is QAB. Sorry. So if you were, if HAB were just a metric of the sphere, then J would be zero. So what this J is measuring is departure of the sphere of a geometric sphere, which is basically what we want to measure, because well, gravitational waves are going to be distorting this sphere. So the weaker these gravitational waves are, the smaller this quantity is.
So the coordinate. So the coordinate transformations alter the sphere. So.
Sure. Then, just to mention briefly the evolution algorithm. because I want to make a point about that. If you think again about just solving the wave equation, and if you introduce coordinates in the way we've done it, just having one of these coordinates being labeling null hypersurfaces, then the usual wave equation gets actually written in this way. And if you think also of introducing another null coordinate that is incoming, then that reduces to this form. And so it's basically an iteration along a null parallelogram. So if you choose two outgoing null hypersurfaces and two incoming, then this equation can be easily integrated, and it will just give you the field evaluated at these four corners. And so it's very simple to integrate. The important thing about this is, well, if you go to the literature about numerical methods, you unfortunately, and at the same time it's a good thing, you don't find anything, because usually people do not integrate equation in the characteristic form. And so you have to basically go and from scratch create your own integration algorithm. And I think this is one of the main reasons for the success of this program, is that, well, an algorithm was created purposely for JR, opposite to the 3+1 case where, well, you basically open a book, you have tons of algorithms to choose from, and then you start trying. Maybe if we were to go to the 3+1 equations, look at them really carefully, and try to create a new algorithm that tries to respect as much as possible what the GR equations are telling you, maybe we wouldn't have such nightmares trying to do it. So this kind of algorithm has been successfully used by many people, well, those that either are in the PIT group or were at some point going through PIT. Was also used for Carson Gundlach Prize and pooling in Utah. David Garfinkel has used it, Piran, and several others. The problem of this algorithm introduced by Isaacson, Gomez, and Winnicore is that it has, for all of you that are doing numerical things, an amplification factor of 1. That is called a marginally stable algorithm. So neither damps nor make the mode grow. The problem when you go and try to apply the nonlinear problems is that usually you run into instabilities and you need a little bit of dissipation to damp the modes that are trying to grow away. And that was by a simple modification of this algorithm, you can get a family of dissipated algorithms that will take care of that for you. As I said the other day, we excise the singularity, we use an incoming formulation. We give outer boundary, and then we integrate radially in, still we find an apparent horizon, or just a trapped surface, and excise that from the computational domain. So we've...
sorry, yes. Your coordinates were...
we can either use outgoing or incoming. In this case, I'm using incoming.
Oh, so we should turn that previous diagram.
Right. Now, I'm now talking about this kind of diagram. We have the similarity here. And you think of your foliation doing this, and you're trying to find this trapped surface or marginally trapped surface. And proof of concept also that excising the singularity in the right way can actually give the results that you expect from the analytic point of view. We choose, in some cases, to use either the marginally trapped surface or just a spherical surface around. Say an origin. So in some cases we run something that looks like this. Say this is the marginally trapped surface, and the origin was here. Here is the sphere. So in one case we excise this from the computational domain. That was the shape of our marginally trapped surface. And in the other case, we choose just a trapped surface that was spherical. And in both cases, we run the code. We compare outside the values of the field at some given point, and we couldn't find any difference from what we obtained numerically. Of course, finding the marginally trapped surface entails evolving solving an elliptic problem, and the typical cause of that in our implementation is about 10 to the third power iterations for the first one. Once you find that, you can use that as a guess, and then you usually need to do a couple of tens, and the And so it doesn't, it's costly in the first time you find it, but from there on, a good enough guess will take you to the solution pretty easily. Well, the code is finished. We are basically not doing anything else, not incorporating many other things to the code. We just run it through a bunch of tests and applications just to see how robust it was. These are the full GR questions. Oh, the thing is, these are the characteristic equations. These are basically, we talk about that the other day, but. Right, I mean, we're using the Bondi characteristic formulation. So we just have two evolution equations, if you want, that for that HAB, which looks like minus B over equals some source. And then you have four hypersurface equations for variables that we call beta, which is basically labels the laps of these hypersurfaces. Then we have a second order equation for a quantity that basically is a shift around the null vertex, and then the V comma R, that's basically the mass aspect of the system, will give you, if you go all the way to sky. These are just hypersurface equations, do not involve time derivatives. So one of the tests was the one we did in the past, and then Bela even tried something that was even more stringent than that. Basically, you put random initial data for a hypersurface and random initial data on the boundary, run the code for as much as you want, and it doesn't run into any instabilities.
What do you mean by random?
You just
no correlations at all.
Right. So you're trying to excite all the modes there,
the shortest wavelength that you
can, including everything. Right.
Remember that the gravitational derivative on the HAB, that's the data that there are no quantum
in the initial non hypersurface. But you have to be careful what you give in the boundary, because things that you give in the initial hypersurface would propagate and will hit the boundary. So if you're not satisfying the constraint, you're making a bad error in the data you're given, even though the code runs stably. That's because, as we talked the other day, one of the nice features of this characteristic thing, if you go all the way to Scry, and the same thing in the case of Peter's code, you have like a toilet flush. Every garbage that you put in goes all the way out to Scry. You never see it again.
So you're posing data on the time-like surface and surface.
Right, both randomly, and even though when this thing hits the boundary, you violate the constraint pretty badly. Whatever you are generating there is taken away basically off the grid and doesn't bother you that much, as in the case of the 3+1, where you have this resonant cavity that could amplify those modes forever, basically, because they just stay there. Right. Right, but you're trying to see if your numerical implementation will grab those modes that you are creating artificially by hand and will just make them grow without any control. Right. Well, because you create it with a small enough amplitude.
You could
create data that strongly focuses and then you're running into singularity. But anyway, it's random weak data. But those modes could be easily amplified if you have an unstable implementation.
Yeah. But I think I understand this as an ability test. But if you try to do something like this, with smooth data, and then look for convergence.
Right. It's just no. This is just. This is just trying to address the stability. Right. It doesn't test. The other thing is that you could try to put smooth enough data, and you could just see where in a short evolution your data makes sense, and I say, well, maybe the code is working and it's doing the right thing, because you haven't let your code run long enough so that it's non-smoothness just because the truncation error that you will have grows enough so that it just it's dominant with respect to the data, the solution you're getting. You mean in the case of in a sensible case or in the case of this test? Well, in a sensible case, if you want to put boundary data, you have to satisfy the constraint. So we have either been reading that data from
what is the data? I mean,
oh, which right? I'm specifying the intrinsic metric of the word here. That's HAB. So the data is given this word here. It's the intrinsic geometry of the word here, HAB. The dimension, yeah.
The word
cube, no. It could be null or time-like. Not well. The slicing is going to be now. I'm going to use. I have to give beta, which does have a relationship with the labs, basically. This labs. So suppose you have an R equal constant. So this combination basically tells you the labs. So that defines the slicing. So that you also have to give at the boundary. You have to give the shift of your coordinates. That's this UA. You have to give the embedding of this virtue in the forward spacetime, and that's the radial derivative of this quantity. This quantity is related to extrinsic curvature. And finally, well, you need an extra piece of information that basically tells you how much mass is contained in this virtue. So given this set of data, you can integrate the equations out or not.
If you're doing the scalar weight equation in classical time,
what would be the analog of the data? Would it be phi, or would it be phi and its normal
derivative?
It'd be phi, just phi. So that would be the
analog
of that.
But you're specifying all of those, and that sounds like too much.
No. Look at the equations that he's evolving over here on the right of the ball. He's a drop in there. Basically, he's looking at these systems of equations, and he needs integration constants.
But it does.
On the world view.
Yeah, but there is a.
Yeah.
This,
that's
I mean, not all of these are you can give freely. There are three constraints basically given by R, U, A, and R. Well, three constraints, R, A, B. This data that you give here better satisfy this Ricci tensor component equals zero. So you could be violating if you give these things that do not satisfy those constraints. So these data are subject to constraints. In the case where this virtue is null, that's what Roberto is going to talk about, and it's much simpler because these are characteristics. So whatever data you're given here doesn't influence the intrinsic geometry that you should give here. So you give the conformal metric of this surface, the conformal metric of this R surface. Then you give basically the embedding of this surface into the forward spacetime. And then there are just ODE equations that you have to integrate along this word here to obtain the rest. And then you automatically satisfy the constraint. But if you try to do this in the time like null word here, then these data are subject to constraints and you have to be careful with that.
So
and that again, you run into a problem similar to the 3+1 problem. So those equations must be satisfied.
So can I just sort of say, supposing I just located the four geometry in the time like surface. So the first two pieces there, all the pieces there, first pieces, are giving me the intrinsic metric. So the minus plus plus metric on that word.
Right. Yeah. This is related to that.
And
the combination, yeah, 1, 2, 3, right.
And then the second regular derivative, that is the same as the full extrinsic curvature? No, it's a part of the extrinsic curvature, right. And then the constraints you're satisfying after the Einstein constraint.
It's basic conservation of momentum going across the point, right.
The Einstein
correct, right. So in order to, this is a pretty difficult problem to do in the time like now case because of, well, what you give here not only depends on what you, there are pieces you've given here, but also on this, on the, what you've given us null data, because it will propagate and you have to satisfy constraints. So far we've tested either in solutions that where we know we can read out those things, or we're obtaining those by matching. If you match to an interior 3 plus 1 evolution, then you can create data that will automatically satisfy the constraint. Right. Well, but so basically this code is finished. It's been tested, thoroughly tested in all the cases we've been able to do, either by knowing analytic solutions or by matching. We've run it for as long as basically we wanted. We run both Schwarzschild and Kerr black holes, putting extra stuff also to try to see how that behaves. We've been able to see that the extraction of these gravitational waves can be, we can have lots of waves coming out and the code will still not break, unless, of course, there is focusing and we have to deal with, well, caustics are present that will break the code. Right, another outstanding issue in the case of the 3 plus 1 evolution is what happens if you have superluminal shifts. Can we handle them or not? The partially causal difference is an answer for that. Well, we are dealing when we're evolving these 3 plus 1 equations inside the Bernoulli horizon, we are dealing with superluminal shifts and causal difference in it is being able to solve those the equations even in that case. And but that's the only code at the moment that can do that. Can yours handle superluminal shifts?
But
in general, that's a tricky point, trying to get your numerical scheme to handle superluminal shifts. And we tested that by hand, putting shifts that are pretty large in this U, and still the code behaves. I still get the data from an exact solution, right. But remember, the shift I can give freely, I can give only at the vertex. From there on, I have to iterate an equation and go all the way to Scry and see what is there. So I could give something that is non-superluminal, and in fact we've seen it, non-superluminal at the vertex. You iterate all the way to Scry, and at Scry you have to deal with a superluminal shift, and still the code doesn't have a problem. Yeah? The vertex, or do you mean Scry? Well, you have a the propagation speeds are space-like. I mean, these are, you can have gauge modes propagating at speeds far faster than the speed of light, and those modes might not be well represented numerically.
Basically, you're also saying that the generation of the scenario.
Yeah.
So can we talk a little philosophical question? The problem is not necessarily well forced,
right?
So, for example, I can take an exact solution. I could give the correct data here,
right?
The wrong data here.
Right.
So what happens? So is it your attitude that we just try this, if it converges, then we know it's a solution. The failure will be reflected in the failing of the convergence test. Is that your attitude?
That would. That's a true statement. Well, the attitude has been, well, always in the back of our mind was either we have a means of putting the right boundary data, say by a double null kind of problem, or if we are in the time like now, we would be able to satisfy the constraint by doing this matching to an interior solution. And if you are not doing the right, if you are ill-posing the problem, then you're not going to be converging to any solution. So as you refine your grid, you see that you're not converging to anything.
I'm only worried about the time like
right.
The time like is, so you're supposed, if I know the solution everywhere, I can understand that I give consistent data on the null surface
right.
And the time vector.
Right.
But if I just have some Cauchy evolution in some little region up here, then, I mean,
well,
the worst case, if you have solution in all this region, then you don't need to do this.
Right.
So if you don't have solution in all this region, then what do you do?
Well, what you have to, in order to give,
your null coordinates are past null coordinates, right? Not future.
Either they can be either one, but it works.
I'm looking for a situation where inside the hyperbolic surface you're going to be doing a conventional free
flow. Right.
Wow.
So that's the main picture we have in mind. So inside here, if you have a 3 plus 1 evolution, and it's a correct evolution, you'll be satisfying the constraint.
You've got stuff coming in that you have boundary conditions on that surface there.
Yeah.
For the inside,
that stuff is going
right,
to
but that stuff is going to be taken into account by this matching. I mean, there's going to be information going in from this area, from this region, and information coming out from the interior area. I mean, these devolutions go hand in hand. In the perfect world, what you should be thinking of is not in this, but in that problem.
So then, in this case, the main motivation for doing this would be to extract the information at level
right.
But in this case, would you not need the initial data of the entire Cauchy slice for really long?
Yeah.
Sure. Sure. Well, yeah. I'm posing. This is the problem I have in mind.
How did you get the correct initial data?
Here.
The null surface. Yeah.
Well, you can give that freely. That is unconstrained.
That's put in by hand.
Anything is correct.
Okay. So the dust one would obtain some solution, but this is a usual problem. And one doesn't know if this is a
physical
interface.
You get it from PDN
right.
Or something like that.
Okay, started.
If the idea is that you suppose that you somehow, already know what's going on inside the cylinder, then instead of using a time-like surface, why don't you just draw a little ingoing null surface and impose your data on that?
Sure.
So that's
it.
That at least really is nicely well-defined.
Well, that's the other thing. But as someone asked the same question yesterday, I think at some point you run out of your Cauchy evolution, and then the characteristic code is going to eventually find a caustic. I mean,
well, I don't mean that. I mean, at each time step,
right, but then you'll do this, and eventually you run out of points in or area in the.
But can you do a stereo set, go back in, go back up?
Like this?
Right. Well,
I mean, and you're.
But then I guess it's an issue of, well, you're trying to solve this with this very current situation when you got all these cores. And if you think that the characteristic working matching is bad, then it'll probably be a little worse.
I asked a question yesterday to which I didn't get an answer. how do you.
Fixed hypersurface?
No, the time-like hypersurface.
Well, it's defined in the usual sense by if you have some coordinates, some gauge coordinate conditions defined in the interior, then you say, okay, let's just use this coordinate. Or if you have coordinates x, y, and z, then it's a function of x, y, and z that equal constant that defines the
right,
word.
But then, how do you define the coordinate? They define the coordinates such that the hypersurface, they take a special value on the hypersurface. I would expect that there must be a law, a propagation law of the hypersurface, which is somehow used.
Yeah, there is. I think that if in the 3 plus 1, it's the rule you use for computing the last two. It'll tell you what that hypersurface is. I mean, you just.
Right, and your coordinates are defined that way.
But then your code contains some way to
specify those as you go along.
Okay, yeah. I mean, there's the probability, yeah.
And we also inherit from whatever evolution is being going on in the inside, the laps on the shift that are being chosen inside are going to be defined in the laps on the shift that we will use.
That's the possibility. I mean, the question is, of course, whether it's possible.
Nobody understands well how to do that choice of laps and shift. That's the way the problem is currently posed.
We've tried both cases. Right, I mean, the coordinates are rotating very quickly around. Right, right.
No,
but I didn't, that.
No art form has been developed for picking the last or the other functionality.
Right, right.
It's free, but there are several prescriptions. They can shift and they can be superluminal. It has no effect on the hypercolicity.
Of course.
It has an effect on the way you code it.
Right. I mean, it doesn't have any effect in the analytic realm. It's a problem in the numerical one because it's tilting your cones. And if you don't do the right thing, I mean, they are working hard on that to cause a difference. It was working hard through that direction. But it, yeah. But if you go and just code naively, then it.
In principle, it's still a big difference.
Sure.
We're not halfway along the road of picking
algebra. Right.
But we know that you can pick anyone.
That's a good thing. So the problem is, let's try to pick the best one.
Yeah.
Another small confusion is, just quick follow-up of what the So in this case, right, I mean, you said that you give some initial data by solving some, on the time-like surface, by solving some quotient problem.
Right.
And then on this null hypothesis, you only give arbitrary initial data.
Right.
So what this means is that I can argue myself initial data here on the time-like surface would satisfy the constraint.
Mm-hmm.
And on the null one, I give arbitrary initial data. Is this problem involved? I can't believe it.
That, if you think it that way. When
you keep evolving both systems together.
You don't give that initial data on the time-like surface.
No. You, it's,
you
it's, an, it's a hand-in-hand evolution there. Right. And so, therefore, we think this code is finished, and we're just using it in different applications. One is going to be what we're going to be talking next, and the other one is that's for a vacuum case. But for a non-vacuum case, we're starting to couple it with a hydrodynamic code that, in characteristic coordinates, that has this high-resolution shock capture scheme, and in principle, you can solve a black hole neutron star problem. Without any of the problems, because I comparing to a 3+1 evolution. Yes.
So I understand this refers to the to this problem.
Yes.
You're not making statements about this problem.
I'm not making statement about that problem. No, but that's the picture one would like to have. Right. Now, in a non-vacuum case, that's what we have. We want to use this characteristic code in a black hole spacetime. We plan to put inner boundary data on the white hole horizon, say, and the event horizon is somewhere here. We'll put our neutron star out here, and by coupling these two codes, we think we can solve the black hole neutron star. In some cases, we don't have that much freedom because depending on where we put this neutron star and how gravitationally strong it is, we'll generate caustics that will kill the evolution. But we know that there is a range of parameters where this code that is pretty robust can solve this problem and give gravitational waveforms that LIGO will be interested in seeing. Right. The data here? Well, suppose you are thinking that. No, you can put it exactly on the event horizon. This could be the white hole horizon of your black hole of your structured spacetime. Because you know that whatever you put in here won't affect this one. It will bring the event horizon closer, and it will change the shape of the event horizon of Schwarzschild, but the data here is completely defined by a Schwarzschild spacetime.
Yeah,
And
not
necessarily, because I mean the cost is a combination of what the focusing power and how far it is. Well, the event horizon is a cost. It can, we know we cannot go past this one. That's what I tried to say the other day, because when, as we get closer to here, we'll have, like, for instance, the time of an observer here going to infinity. But past the event horizon, we're not interested. We know we're not going to be getting signals for LIGO but inside if past the event horizon.
Well, so almost all event horizons don't form as a nice spherical thing. They get cut. It's all over them.
Yeah, right.
The horizon
correct. But we can go almost up to that point, and we think most of the interesting waves are going to be already seen up to, before that point. By what? Well, we, in the case of a neutron star black hole collision, you expect that the neutron star will be tidally disrupted in the last stable or in the last orbit, and there it's going to be the burst of radiation is going to be produced, and then there is going to be this ringing down of the effect being seen here. The ringing down effect, well, that's pretty well understood by perturbation theory, but this initial burst of radiation will appear in this area. We won't have to go that far. And I think, future issues is, getting boundary data that is relevant for problems, and one of them is the Cauchy characteristic matching, where we're still working on. Again, these non-vacuum problems where we're trying to work, and so we have this project with Philippos Papadopoulos and Tony Font about doing this, and we're starting to parallelize the code. Not that we actually need to parallelize the code to do vacuum, but it's very likely that in this case we'll need a parallel code so that we have enough resolution for the hydro to work properly. So now it's Roberto Gomez talking about it.